Hello and welcome to the Tudor Her Story. Today I am talking to Adam Pennington about Lady Margaret Pottle. So today we are talking about Lady Margaret Pottle, Countess of Salisbury.
Yes.
But I thought first we could talk a little bit about you and where your interest in the Tudors began.
Sure. So I think really it was kind of woven into my DNA from birth. So I grew up on the border between Surrey and London, which meant that Tudor history was always quite present. So a big part of that is the fact that my childhood home overlooked Nonsuch Park, which is the park that is the home of the sadly lost Palace of Nonsuch. So that was literally on my doorstep, and that also meant that Hampton Court Palace was just 15 minutes down the road, central London with the Tower and all of the other big sort of London destinations was just 20 minutes on the tube. So it was kind of always around me, and my mum has always loved history and really encouraged my sister and I to know our history. And then I remember very vividly when I was studying the Tudors for the first time around year six, year five, year six. I think it was in the 6 weeks holiday, Anne of a Thousand Days just by chance was on TV. And my mum let me watch it, even though I'd only been about 10. But she allowed me to watch Anne of a Thousand Days. And from there I was hooked.
Oh, it's always that film, isn't it? It's either that or the Tudors.
I'm definitely not Team Tudors.
Oh,
I know it's beloved by lots of people, but I'm a bit controversial in the fact that I hated Natalie Dormer as Anne Boleyn, and I know a lot of people love her as Anne Boleyn, and I just didn't. I think she's a wonderful actress. I loved her in Game of Thrones, but I just thought I hated her as that. I thought she was so poorly cast as Anne Boleyn, but I know I'm in the minority there.
I used to love the Tudors, and I tried to rewatch it 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't sit there. I couldn't sit still.
Yeah, I think it's what annoys me about the Tudors is I think it's patronizing to the audience because it's just to me. And again, I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, it drew huge audiences to Tudor history, which is wonderful. But I just thought it was really dumbed down in a lot of ways. For example, the fact that Henry VIII's two sisters' storylines were just merged into this weird sort of joint storyline of Mary and Margaret's, but it was named Margaret, but the storyline was more Mary. I just thought it was as if the audience would struggle with the idea that the king had two sisters. So stuff like that. I just thought it was silly and I thought it was overly sexed. I thought the costumes were atrocious. Yeah, I'm much more sort of geared towards I'm much more lean towards things like Wolf Hall, which I thought was a masterpiece.
Yes, I love Wolf Hall. I can't wait for series two.
I know, and a little birdie told me that they were filming at Hampton Court today.
Oh,
And yeah.
I can't wait. But so we've covered why you love the Tudor period a little bit. Obviously,
Yeah.
you watched Anne of a Thousand Days. But have you got a favourite Tudor?
I do, and it is such a cliche, but it is Anne Boleyn. And I say that long before Natalie Dormer came along. I think Anne Boleyn is obviously enormously popular, and I'm by no means alone in the fact that she's my favourite Tudor. I just think her story was so astonishing, and I think a big draw to her story is also her aloofness in some respects. She is by far and away the most famous of Henry VIII's wives, and yet fundamentals such as how old she was or what she truly looked like are still being discussed at length. Her story, it was just so extraordinary. She was essentially plucked from relative obscurity. She overturned the status quo. She became queen, and less than 3 years later gets beheaded. It's a wild story. And I think the success of her daughter's reign is another part of what a lot of people love about Anne Boleyn's story, because Elizabeth superseding her father as the greatest Tudor monarch in many respects is, probably the biggest bit of cosmic karma ever, I would say.
No, absolutely. Anne Boleyn's my favourite. I make no secrets about it. But she's my favourite. But we are talking about Margaret Pohl today. And I thought we could just briefly talk about, you've got a book coming out in July, I believe.
Yes, I have, yes.
What made you want to write a book on the Margaret Pohl and her family?
It honestly came to me. It wasn't a situation where I actively looked to do it. So I have a blog, and I wrote a blog post about the downfall of Margaret Pohl. And it got seen by a publishing house, who then contacted me and said, would you consider writing a book about the Pohl family? Because there's been a couple of books about Margaret Pohl specifically, but there's not been something which looks more broadly at Margaret, but also her children and their careers. And I said, sure, I'd be open to the idea of writing a book about them, but didn't have any expectation. I didn't go into it expecting that I would write a book about them. So it sort of came to me, really. And that's how I wrote the book. But it is coming out this July. It's called Henry VIII and the Plantagenet Poles, The Rise and Fall of a Dynasty. And it, as I mentioned, explores the whole Pohl family. So her children, some of her grandchildren, and Margaret, obviously, as the sort of central character.
Well, that is definitely another book added to pre-order. I haven't got 12 million pre-ordered this year because there's so many coming out, but it sounds very exciting.
Thank you.
So, Margaret Pohl, the early years, it's quite often overlooked how interlinked with the royal family in her early years she is. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk about who her parents were and her uncles especially.
Yes, yeah. I mean, she wasn't interlinked with the royal family. She was of the royal family,
yeah.
Is how I would definitely see it. She was the... So Margaret was born on the 14th of August, 1472 at Farley Hungerford Castle, which isn't too far from Bath in the southwest of England. And she was born to essentially the second man in the kingdom. So her father was George, Duke of Clarence, and her mother was Isabel Neville. She was actually the second born child to the couple. She had an older sibling who died literally within minutes of being born, to such a degree that we don't even know the baby's gender. But 3 years after, so then Margaret came along. She was the first child born to George, Duke of Clarence, and Isabel Neville, who outlived childhood. 3 years after her birth, she was joined by a brother, Edward. And by virtue of who her father was and her mother, she was at the very apex of the 15th century society, basically, because both her parents were phenomenally noble. So her father was the younger brother of King Edward IV, who was on the throne at the point that Margaret was born. So at birth, she was a blood-related niece of the king, and she was a niece in the male line, which also counted for a lot more. Her mother was also hugely important in her own right because she was the elder of the two daughters of Edward Neville, Earl of Warwick, who is known to history as the Kingmaker, as he was the man who ultimately helped put Edward IV on the throne and remove Henry VI. And because he had no sons, Isabel and her younger sister Anne were the joint heiresses to his vast fortune. I mean, the Earl of Warwick literally had properties from Cornwall, almost practically to the border of Scotland. So his daughters were the wealthiest heiresses in England. So that was Margaret's mother. And then her father was a brother of Edward IV and also the older brother of Richard III. So her father was the brother of two of England's kings, and that made her the niece of two of England's kings.
Wow, that's some lineage to have, isn't it? Definitely.
Yes.
So do we know where Margaret grew up? Was she at the royal court, or was she brought up in the country?
She was predominantly brought up... Well, it's difficult to say with certainty because the early years of her life were quite volatile because of her father's behaviour. Her father was not a particularly content man and had a lot of strife with his older brother. And it naturally placed issues on Margaret's early life. And she lost her mother quite early as well. So as best we can tell, she spent most of her time away from court at Farley Hungerford Castle or her parents' other seats. But there isn't a huge amount about what she was doing in her very early years, other than we know that it was incredibly grand, and that can be gleaned from the records of what her father's income was, and I'll come on to discuss that in a bit. But exactly where she was at certain times is actually quite difficult to pin down.
It's always, I watched The White Queen a few years ago, and it shows her being brought up by her aunt, Queen Anne Neville. Do you think that was true, or do you think that's just Philippa Gregory pulling strings?
There is some truth in there, and we're jumping ahead slightly, but yes, there was a period when, well, again, we have to look at the gaps and take some calculated assumptions, which is what Philippa Gregory was basically doing. But during the reign of Richard III, which was a short reign, he only reigned for 2 years, Edward of Warwick, so Margaret's younger brother, was housed at Sheriff Hutton Castle in Yorkshire, which was King Richard's main northern seat. And he was housed there, and it is likely that Margaret was housed there as well with her brother. But that was, you know, by this point she was in her teens, so her earlier life would have been spent with, you know, her parents. But she lost her parents quite young, just because of what happened. Because I think the thing to bear in mind with Margaret, Margaret's story, is the point at which she was born is that the country was still relatively volatile. There was, you know, her uncle Edward IV was on the throne, but the Wars of the Roses the Wars of the Roses is sort of like a bit of an inaccurate name, really. I mean, firstly, to the people who it concerned, they called it the Cousins' War, but it also makes it sound like there was a constant battle going on, and actually that's not the case at all. The Wars of the Roses, as we now call them, lasted over 30 years, and there were many periods during that 30-year window where it was where there was relative peace and many years of calm. And at the point that Margaret was born, her uncle Edward IV had finally defeated Henry VI. Henry VI had been dealt with, and so for all intents and purposes, it looked like the Yorks were there to stay. But then one of the big problems that Margaret's father came up against was Edward IV's decision to marry Elizabeth Woodville. And one of the things that the White Queen does portray is George, Duke of Clarence's dislike for Elizabeth Woodville. And based on all of my research and what I was able to discover, that was very much the case. That was accurate. Both Margaret's father, George, Duke of Clarence, and Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, greatly disliked Elizabeth Woodville and disliked the huge influence that she had over the king. And the fact that there's that scene in, I mean, I'm always dubious with Philippa Gregory, but I will admit that I enjoy The White Queen as a drama. But there's that scene in The White Queen where Elizabeth Woodville and her mother, Jacquetta, are busy plotting all of the marriages of Elizabeth's siblings. And again, that's also totally true. And that was one of the things that really angered the George, Duke of Clarence, and the Earl of Warwick, because they just suddenly saw the court that they'd built being totally taken over by these scheming Woodvilles as they saw them. So it was quite a volatile time. And Margaret was sort of pushed around from pillar to post following her father's execution, because, you know, when her father was eventually executed by being drowned in a barrel of Malmsey wine, which again, based on as much as research as I could do, appears to have been the case. Thereafter, you know, his children were the children of a tainted traitor, and it made life a bit more challenging for them. Their mother had died at the age of just 25. So yeah, Margaret's early life was quite volatile, even though she was born at, you know, the very apex of the sort of the Plantagenet reign that she was born into.
Yeah, absolutely. You think once it's, is it 1472 Henry the Sixth is defeated? Is that, yes. You'd think it's more stable, but obviously George, Duke of Clarence, did not, was never a content person, as you say.
No, he was
When,
never content, and it massively, it placed a real, it placed a big weight of sort of, his children were just sort of tarred by association in many respects. But I think one of the details that I think is really touching, actually, there's a portrait of what many believe to be Margaret Pole in her later years. And the portrait is definitely of an elderly Tudor lady wearing clothing appropriate to the 1530s. And, you know, she's wearing what appears to be ermine fur, which would be a sign of the sitter's really high status. But the suggestion that it's Margaret Pole is a really tiny clue, which is that if you look very closely on her right wrist, she's wearing a bracelet, and there's a charm hanging from the bracelet, which is a barrel of wine. And that is seen as a sort of a sign that this is Margaret Pole, and that the charm was a reminder of her father, who had been executed by being drowned in a barrel of wine.
That's really interesting. I'm going to be looking at that portrait after we finish our talk, if I can find it on Google. Anyway.
Yeah, you can. It's a very well known. It's the only portrait of her that really is in existence. You'll be able to find it very easily.
All right. Okay. Brilliant. That's my evening sorted after this. Would you say once her father was executed, well, it did obviously leave it unstable, but what happened for Margaret and her brother Edward? What happened?
They were taken into the household of Edward IV's children. So after the death of George, Duke of Clarence, Margaret was essentially raised among her princess cousins. So Margaret, although she was born to the king's brother, she wasn't known as Princess Margaret of Clarence. She was Lady Margaret of Clarence, but she was recognised as a princess of the House of York. It's a bit of a weird one. She didn't have the title, but she was recognised very much as a member of the royal family. And after her father's execution, she lodged with her cousins, so predominantly Elizabeth of York and Cecily of York and the other sort of York princesses.
Right, that's really interesting because, again, it's Philippa Gregory and the White Queen that I'm referring to when I think of Margaret Pole, which is scandalous, I know.
Yeah.
But I know, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. She's brought, you know, these characters to whole new audiences. I'm much more forgiving of her work. I take that back. I'm much more forgiving of things like The White Queen than I am The Other Boleyn Girl, because I think The Other Boleyn Girl is a travesty. But The White Queen, I kind of quite enjoy it, even though, yes, it's filled with inaccuracies in many respects.
Is it Max Irons? Because that's what does it for me.
Yeah. That's the hilarious thing, actually. I was talking to Gareth Streeter, who runs the Instagram account Royal History Geeks. He was on my podcast a while ago. And I was saying that I just have this massive soft spot for Edward IV. And he said, is it Max Irons? And I was like, yeah, I think it is.
So yeah, whenever someone says, I like The White Queen, I went, is it Max Irons?
Is it Max Irons? Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. When Edward IV died, so I'm jumping forwards now to 1483. Yeah, where did it leave Margaret? Because obviously everything changes in 1483.
Yeah, so when Edward IV died, Margaret's position really didn't change very much. The only thing that is of note is that when Edward IV died and then Edward V, so the elder of the two princes in the tower, was briefly proclaimed king, and then he was, you know, famously ousted by Richard III, and historians remain very torn as to whether Richard III killed his nephews or they escaped. You know, there's been that recent documentary from Philippa Langley that, you know, that she believes that they did escape. Ultimately, at this point, Margaret and her brothers lives didn't change enormously. But one thing that did happen, which is an interesting thing to consider, is that part of Richard III's process to secure the throne was the fact that he had it decreed that the children born to Edward IV were illegitimate due to Edward IV's supposed earlier marriage alliance with, I think she was called Eleanor Clifford, I think off the top of my head, don't quote me on it, but I'm fairly certain she was called Eleanor Clifford or Eleanor Butler, it's one of the two. And Richard III used that supposed former marriage contract to remove Edward IV's children from the line of succession. If we follow the strict rules of primogeniture, in which it is not defined by the age of someone, but by the order in which they're born, actually, after Edward IV's children are named illegitimate, the heir to the throne should have been Margaret's brother, Edward Earl of Warwick, because he was the son of Edward IV's middle brother, Richard was, so you had Edward, then George, then Richard. So under the rules of strict primogeniture, technically in the line of succession, Margaret and her brother were ahead of Richard III in the line of succession. However, he decided that due to their father's attainder, that they were also to be removed from the line of succession, even though there was absolutely no precedence for this. And technically, I would say it was an illegal move, and it was one that he, it was a very convenient way of basically clearing two other people from his snatching the throne. And it's his actions in doing that that add, for me, more weight to the argument that he very deliberately took the throne. Because if he was going about it from a sort of purely selfless approach, then the rightful heir would have been Margaret's brother. But Richard conveniently for him decided that she and her brother were also to be removed from the line of succession. So other than that, really their situation didn't change very much during the reign of Richard III, and only really changed very significantly when the Tudors came onto the throne.
But going to the 22nd of August 1485, when, yeah, that is right, when Richard III dies, what change? Obviously, it's a huge change, but for Margaret and Edward, what changes for them? Because they're now seen as a threat.
Yeah, it's a huge change. I mean, it's a colossal shift. Things did not look good for Margaret and the rest of her family. She was a very prominent member of the House of York. And the thing to also really keep in mind is that the House of York were really popular with the people, particularly in London. Even in the earlier stages of the Wars of the Roses, Edward IV, even at the point that he took the throne, he was beloved by the people of London. And the Tudors were, by and large, nobodies. And the so, you know, there was a real sense that the pole, sorry, not the pole, that Margaret and her cousins, the York princesses and Margaret's brother, were a major threat to the safety and the security of the new Tudor throne. And Margaret was definitely safer than her brother in many respects. And what ultimately made her safer came down to her sex. So the thing also to factor in is that the Tudors were a really small family. I mean, you could literally count on one hand the Tudors, but the Yorks were a vast family. And really, we all know that the Tudors were only able to really solidify their rule by aligning with the York's greatest prize, which was obviously Elizabeth of York, the eldest child and the eldest daughter of Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville. And what the Tudors did was to basically use the oldest trick in the book and to marry off the remaining senior females from the House of York to trusted members of the Tudor affinity. And that's what they did. So they married off Elizabeth of York, obviously, to Henry VII himself. And then the sort of the most potent problems for the Tudors were the the older York girls, of which Margaret was one of them. Now, in Margaret's husband's case, she was married off to Sir Richard Pole, and the marriage was viewed as grossly unequal, and was viewed by many of the Yorkists as a shamefully poor marriage for a girl who was born basically all but a princess. So Sir Richard Pole had a single claim to the nobility, but it was tenuous at best. His maternal grandfather was a half sibling of Margaret Beaufort. So th there was a very tenuous link to Henry VII's mother, basically. But as I've previously mentioned, Margaret Pole, as she was now known, was the niece of two of England's kings. And to put into perspective just how vastly different their circumstances were, Sir Richard Pole's annual income was valued at £50. Margaret's father's annual income had been £6,000. So the difference in what Margaret had been born to what she ended what she ended up marrying was just enormous. So in that sense, it was a real downgrade. They're growing up, she would have expected to marry probably at very least a duke, maybe even a foreign ruler. But here she was marrying someone whose annual income was tiny compared to what she'd grown up with. It did, however, provide safety and security, which I think is something that by this point Margaret would have treasured. And it was also a successful marriage. They had five children. They had four boys: Henry, Arthur, Reginald, and Geoffrey, and a daughter, Ursula, who was born between Arthur and Reginald. Her brother was in a much more precarious position. As I mentioned earlier, with the princes in the tower, declared dead or missing, Margaret's brother was seen as the sort of de facto heir to the Yorkists, and for that reason, he was basically imprisoned from the age of 10 and would never leave its walls, save for a couple of moments when he was brought out to prove that he was who he said he was. So there have been a couple of claims that Edward, Earl of Warwick, as he was known, was mentally unstable, and it's definitely something that in The White Princess is sort of portrayed that he was that by his later years he'd basically gone insane. And my understanding and what I concluded is that's not quite accurate, and that actually he was just very unworldly. He'd been imprisoned from the age of 10, and it's not unsurprising that by being imprisoned from that early age, and therefore thereafter having no further education, he just was very unworldly. And someone once famously quipped that he couldn't discern the difference between a goose and a capon. But I think that that's less that he was insane and more that he'd been imprisoned since he was a child, and really had not seen much of the world. And I think that so he was in a much more difficult position just by virtue of the fact that he was a boy. And there are two factors to what led to his eventual execution, which came in November 1499. The first is that he became caught up in an escape attempt from the Tower of London alongside Perkin Warbeck, who is the young man who claimed to be Richard, Duke of York, so the younger of the missing princes in the Tower. But secondly, and I think more significantly, there was the upcoming marriage between Prince Arthur, the heir of Henry VII, and the Spanish princess Catherine of Aragon. And it's believed that Catherine's parents, Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, they would not allow their daughter to travel to England until all serious contenders to the throne had been dealt with. And Edward, Earl of Warwick, was at the top of that list, and that is ultimately what forced Henry VII's hand in authorizing his execution. So Margaret was married off to someone far below her in status, but she got security. Very sadly for her brother, it ended in his death.
It is just sad. I hate reading about the Edward, Earl of Warwick.
Yeah, it's a really, really sad story.
Do Do we know if how Margaret felt? Obviously, she's going to be upset because it's her brother, but is there any evidence that she was publicly upset about it?
There isn't, but I think that is just by virtue of the fact that history is written by the victors, and she was by now, when she married Richard Pole, she became his wife. She became Lady Pole. She was no longer, the sort of high and mighty daughter of a duke. And so what she thought would have been acknowledged, but certainly wasn't written down. I think it's fair to say that she would have been heartbroken. He was the last remaining link to the parents that they had barely known. But we can't say what she felt about it. The only hint that we get comes much later, when she requested the return of the lands and the title that had been taken from her brother by Henry VII. When she eventually approached Henry VIII about that, which I'm sure we'll come to, she did bring up her brother, and there's a hint in what she says to Henry VIII that suggests that she always maintained her brother's innocence. But as far as speaking out against Henry VII's actions, there's nothing recorded. But I'm sure she was heartbroken and furious. But there's nothing recorded, and there doesn't appear to have been any animosity between her and Catherine of Aragon, despite the fact that Catherine of Aragon's marriage only really went ahead because Margaret's brother had died.
So you've very cleverly brought in Catherine of Aragon for me there to bring on to my next question. What was Margaret's role in the upcoming marriage of Arthur and Catherine?
So we can't say for certain when Margaret first met Catherine. Her role actually just came simply via her husband. So Richard Pole had been appointed as Prince Arthur's Lord Chamberlain, essentially the person who ran his household in the Welsh Marches. And because Margaret was not at this stage, she wasn't acting as a lady in waiting to her cousin the Queen. She went with her husband to the Welsh Marches. In fact, their fourth child, Reginald, was born at Stourton Castle in Staffordshire, which was their main base that had been given to them. And so, just by virtue of her husband's role, Margaret was very much part of Arthur's household. And it's certainly my belief that Margaret would have been at the royal wedding, given her position as the wife of the prince's Lord Chamberlain. So it's possible that's where they first met. There's also the chance that Margaret wasn't at the wedding and that she was instead sort of in Wales getting the house ready for the newlyweds. But that's really how the relationship started. That's how Margaret came to be friends with Catherine, was via her husband's position as the Lord Chamberlain to Catherine's short-lived first husband.
Yes, very short-lived. When Arthur died, what happened for Richard? It is Richard Pole, isn't it?
So he carried on, sort of in the employ of the Tudor reign. He carried on in the employ of Henry VII. And the thing is that even though Catherine and Arthur were only married for 5 months, in that 5 month window, Margaret and Catherine did become very close, despite the fact that that Margaret's brother had been executed to essentially ensure Catherine's marriage went ahead. I think ultimately what drove this closeness, though, was what they then experienced thereafter and what they would experience under Henry VII. So Catherine was 12 years younger than Margaret, so there wasn't a huge age gap. And like Catherine, she'd been away, she'd been raised predominantly away from her parents. She'd lost her parents early. Catherine had been taken from Spain at quite a young age. And after the death of Arthur Tudor, Catherine's position at the Tudor court was really tenuous. And it sort of acted as a real sort of, I think, it acted as a real driving force between Margaret and Catherine. They were both dedicated to the traditional Catholic faith. And, you know, they were also, they shared the joint grief of losing both their husbands, because Sir Richard Pole died just a year and a bit after Prince Arthur's death. And in the wake of both of their respective husbands' deaths, they were basically left in incredibly challenging financial circumstances. They had large households that they oversaw, and it actually got so dire for Margaret that she gave her third son, Reginald, over to the church as a means of alleviating some of the financial pressure that she faced. And so I think, and it's, you know, well known and well documented that Catherine of Aragon was basically destitute after Arthur's death under the reign of Henry VII. And so I think this really sort of bonded the two women together. You know, they had this joint love of the Catholic faith. They were both very, very religious. So I think that and their sort of shared experience of suffering ultimately under Henry VII is what drove their closeness.
No, I completely agree with you. I love reading about their friendship. I think it's such a nice friendship, and I completely agree with you on the point of I think they just shared trauma.
Yeah, totally.
And it bonded them. Do you have any theories on why Henry VII didn't help Margaret after Richard Pole died?
It's a really difficult one. I think ultimately he knew that in her children ran the blood of the family that he'd overthrown. He was very famously extremely parsimonious. He hated spending money. He was a miser. That's, you know, one of the very well documented parts of Henry VII's story. And I think that he saw her as now he basically did the bare minimum, and it was, you know, his view was she gets her widow's pension, she is the late wife of Richard Pole, she is no longer Lady Margaret of Clarence, and my sense is that he dealt with her in a way that he now deemed appropriate to her station in life, which would all change enormously when his son came to the throne. But Henry VII was a very different character to his son, well, at least in the early days of Henry VIII's reign. And I think that was a big factor in why he kept her and other prominent members of the sort of remaining Plantagenet dynasty sort of quite downtrodden. It was to just ensure continued governance and sort of security of the Tudor dynasty, because it was a fledgling dynasty. You know, anyone who has studied the period can see that they had basically no claim to the throne, or at least a very tenuous one. So I think Henry VII's treatment was a way of just keeping Margaret and her ilk sort of in the place that he now felt they should exist, I suppose.
No, yeah. It's because I've watched The White Queen and The White Princess, so it is just scandalous where my knowledge comes from. I do know more about Margaret Pole, but it's because of thinking of The White Princess in my head. Do you think, this is a bit of myth-busting, I suppose, do you think she did a plot against him, or do you think she was much more intelligent than that?
Against Henry VII?
Yeah.
No, I don't see any... There was nothing in the records that I found to suggest that she plotted against Henry VII. I think it's fair to say that she would have been, she was very famously close to her cousin, Elizabeth of York, which goes a long way to explaining some of Henry VIII's later actions. So I think that Margaret, by virtue of her closeness with her cousin, wouldn't have plotted against Henry VII. Because to plot against Henry VII was to plot against her cousin, and, you know, who she was very fond of.
No, yeah, I was thinking, you know, obviously you've researched Margaret's life extensively, so, and I know a lot. I don't know if you get this on Instagram and on your podcast. Do you get a lot of people that have watched Stars or The Tudors and gone, "This is true"? Oh. Why are you?
Yes, so funnily enough, you ask for a bugbear, I think, at the end of this episode.
Yes.
And my bugbear is people need to stop paying attention to these types of dramas because they are, by and large, fictitious. So, yeah, I mean, I had someone the other day quoting the other Boleyn girl as irrefutable proof that Anne Boleyn was older than Mary Boleyn. And I just said, look, you're wrong and go away.
I love
Yeah.
that response. But no, that is why I asked about do you think she plotted, is
No, I
because a
don't.
lot of people believe it.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
When Henry VII dies, do
Yeah.
things finally improve for Margaret?
They improve immeasurably. Yes, yeah, they do. So, Margaret. The big thing about the shift from Henry VII to Henry VIII, certainly in the early years of Henry VIII's reign, is that Henry VIII was molded in the guise of his maternal grandfather. So he was cut from the same cloth as Edward IV. The two looked a lot alike. They were both, Henry VIII was famously very tall and broad and handsome, as was Edward IV. So he was the polar opposite in many respects of his father. He was much more like his maternal grandfather. And that also manifested itself in the early years of his reign by his showing much greater favor to the White Rose network of cousins than his father ever did. And when I talk about the White Rose network, I'm talking about the families with strong Yorkist blood in their veins. So the Poles, the Courtenays, the Staffords, and so on. And I think a big, big part of what was driving that was the fact that Henry VIII idolized his mother. And so it's clear that he wanted to surround himself with her people rather than those from his father and grandmother. And things took a huge jump for Margaret in 1512 when, quite possibly, at the suggestion of Catherine of Aragon, because Henry VIII, obviously, one of the first things he did was to take Catherine of Aragon down the aisle, despite the fact that his grandmother was supposedly horrified. He did, go ahead with marrying her. And that could only ever help Margaret Pole because the two were close. In 1512, Margaret petitioned the king to restore her family's lands and titles, including the most important of the titles, which was the Earldom of Salisbury. And a mark of just how well Henry VIII evidently felt of her is that not only did she win the king over, but he granted everything back, but he made it even more special because he decided to pass the Salisbury earldom to Margaret directly rather than passing it to her eldest son, who was also called Henry. And this was really, really unusual. There are only three women across the entire reign of Henry VIII who held titles in their own right. And the most famous is Anne Boleyn, who was made Marquess of Pembroke prior to her marriage to the king. But the other most notable one is Margaret Pole, because Henry VIII basically declared that she would be what's called a femme sole. And the title was passed to her in her own right. So she became known as the Countess of Salisbury. And it meant that she basically got back countless swathes of land and properties. Again, her properties, a bit like her grandfather, they ran from Cornwall basically to Scotland. I mean, she became overnight unbelievably wealthy with vast estates at her fingertips. She became the fifth richest peer in England, and that was a list in which she was the only woman as well, which is something to also factor in. So yeah, I mean, she literally went from rags to riches almost overnight with the ascendancy of Henry VIII to the throne. And it is also this closeness that led to Margaret being made the Lady Governess to Princess Mary, so the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. And as best as I could tell, this was something that was asked of her personally by the King and Queen. And again, I think that there's a couple of things in as to why that happened. Firstly, the Queen's closeness to Margaret, so she would have been seen as a safe pair of hands. But she was also, I suppose she could, Margaret Pole kind of represented what we might now call old school. Like the King trusted her, they were cousins. You know, he knew that his mother was very fond of her. She was a really natural choice to be the governess for the young princess. You know, as much as she'd suffered under Henry VII, she'd always been an incredibly, by birth, a very, very noble person, and therefore knew exactly how the court ran. And it would have been a very obvious choice for Mary to be given her as a governess.
No, yes. I was just going to ask, before you mentioned being governess, was before Margaret was governess, was she lady-in-waiting for Catherine of Aragon?
She was, yeah, she was a lady-in-waiting.
So in this early years of Henry VIII, what was, obviously we know Margaret benefited very well, but did it benefit her children as well? You know, did they make wealthy marriages and such?
Yeah, they absolutely did. So with the restoration of all of their fortunes, the Margaret could then immediately start planning to also ensure that her four marriageable children also had good marriages. And I say four marriageable children because her third son, Reginald, by going into the church from a young age, was not expected to marry. And so the marriages that Margaret negotiated were for her eldest son and heir, Henry Pole, and then her second son, Arthur, her daughter, Ursula, and finally her son, Geoffrey. And Margaret organised quite prominent marriages for the children, but the most prominent in many respects was the marriage of her daughter. So he was a grandson of Edward IV. And so by marrying her daughter Ursula to the son and heir of the Duke of Buckingham, Margaret was essentially guaranteeing that her daughter would in time, all being well, become the Duchess of Buckingham. And at this point, the Buckingham Dukedom was the most senior dukedom in the most senior non-royal dukedom in the country. So it was a phenomenal match for Ursula Pole. But equally, it was a very good match for the Duke of Buckingham's son because, you know, Ursula was the sole daughter of a countess of royal blood as well. So it meant that, so, you know, the fortunes that were restored to Margaret enabled her to negotiate these marriages. And from the records, she was quite a feisty negotiator. She played a massive role in the terms and conditions, we might say, of her children's marriages. And she also, you know, she provided money based on whether, you know, if the children had sons, you know, she would pay more versus if they had daughters and stuff like that. She was quite a tough cookie when it came to negotiating the contracts and the T's and C's, really, of what the marriages were. But yeah, the fact that their mother was so restored and so senior as in the sort of English nobility was a huge win for the Pole children.
No, yeah, I was just going. My next question is, you know, obviously being a favourite, when the Duke of Buckingham was executed in 1521, yeah, did that kind of cast a shadow over them or did it not touch them whatsoever?
No, it did cast a shadow, and it was the first shadow cast on Margaret since Henry VIII came to the throne. Thankfully, it didn't last too long. So when the Duke of Buckingham was arrested and imprisoned and eventually executed, Henry Pole, so Margaret's eldest son, was also implicated. It was suggested that basically that he had covered up the Duke of Buckingham's supposedly treasonous talk and was imprisoned in the Tower of London, as was George Baron Bergavenny, who was the father of Henry Pole's wife. And it basically, over the period that the Duke of Buckingham was imprisoned, it did cast a shadow over Margaret and her family. And during that time, Margaret was removed as Mary's governess. and basically went and lived quietly in the country and just waited for better times. And then better times came relatively soon. And the way that it was sort of, the way that we are able to figure out that there was a softening of relationship between Henry VIII and Margaret Pole was, it was quite a simple thing, but it's actually a really useful tool, which is if you're looking at the Christmas gift lists, for example, it was around 1522, I want to say, that the, no, a couple of years later, Margaret's gift to the king was not returned. And it was sort of, that was seen as the first sign that things were beginning to soften and that, you know, Margaret was slowly but surely, and her family, being returned to favour. And she was then reinstated as Princess Mary's governess. Her son was released from the Tower without charge. Obviously, the Duke of Buckingham did get executed, and that had a massive, that had massive consequences for Ursula Pole, because, you know, she, Margaret had negotiated this marriage with the expectation that Ursula would become the Duchess of Buckingham in time, but with the Duke of Buckingham's execution and attainder, all of that wealth, all of those titles went to the crown, and Ursula was basically now the daughter-in-law of an attainted traitor, and again lived quite a quiet life up in Staffordshire in the Midlands, and wouldn't gain any noble title for many years to come. And when they did get a noble title, it was a barony, which is the lowest on the rung of noble titles. So it was a far cry from the very grand marriage that they had expected it would eventually lead. It was a far cry from the grand future that had been expected.
They're just done dirty all the time, aren't they? Just, yeah. As you were saying, that's just like, they just keep getting done dirty all the time.
Yeah, very much. And it also, the marriages of Margaret's sons also just didn't go the way that, you know, that they would have liked. And a big part of that was the fact that, so Arthur Pole, Margaret's second son, was married to a girl called Jane Lucanor. And her father, Jane was the sort of joint co-heiress of her father. And then years later, her father remarried and had a load more kids. And it meant that Arthur's children's inheritance became enormously watered down. And this happened actually a couple of times. I think, it happened to Geoffrey Pole as well. So basically all of the marriages that Margaret negotiated that on paper were really advantageous ended up turning into very, very little gain for the Pole family in the end.
Interesting. I'm going to be doing some research on Ursula Pole especially. As I think I listened to your podcast episode a bit ago, and I had to listen to it twice because I was just like, that's really interesting. So we know in the late 1520s, Henry VIII casts a fancy to someone that we all know, Anne Boleyn.
Yeah, that little known character.
Just, she's a side character, really.
Totally.
Do we know what Margaret, who Margaret's side was, who was she on? Was it Catherine of Aragon, perhaps?
Oh, it was Catherine of Aragon all the way. Funnily enough, is that Margaret is not particularly visible at this time. She sort of kept her head down and was mostly away from the court. The king's decision to part from Catherine of Aragon was met with horror by the Pole family, particularly with Margaret, who was very loyal to Catherine. And Margaret was by no means alone in that. You know, it's a well-known fact that the decision to try and marry Anne Boleyn was not popular. But one of the things that's really prominent, the characters that among whom the decision to for Henry to marry Anne, it was hated mostly by a lot of the very senior women at the court. Mm. And these included the king's younger sister, Princess Mary, Margaret herself, Gertrude Courtenay, the Marchioness of Exeter. And this group of women remained very loyal to Catherine, and by extension of that, very loyal to her daughter's interests, so the interests of Princess Mary. The other thing to also factor in is that the Pole family were naturally conservative by nature when it came to religion. So religious reform was anathema to them. And that was something that, so it was kind of like a double whammy. They really didn't want Anne Boleyn to displace Catherine of Aragon, and they really didn't want what became known as the dissolution of the monasteries to take place, because they were committed to the true, sort of pure Catholic faith of the time. Now, with that said, the older of the Pole boys, Henry and Arthur, did support the king in his aims to get the divorce from Catherine of Aragon, and they willingly put their name to the bills, and they willingly signed the Act of Supremacy and all the rest of it. But it's my firm belief that it was pure lip service, and that their loyalty ultimately remained with Catherine, and that they were doing what they had to do to survive. Is how I would definitely characterize their actions at the time. The Pole family were also, because they were one of the oldest noble families in the country, they had a real distaste for Thomas Cromwell, who was obviously another big figure who was really coming through the ranks at this time. And actually, this only exacerbated their eventual downfall. The big thing around this time that actually sort of starts the downfall of the Pole family was Reginald Pole. So the fourth child, Margaret's third son, fourth child, who, as I've mentioned, was given over to the church in his youth to try and alleviate the pressures on Margaret's already strained finances. And he rose through the church, and he was eventually educated in Padua, at Padua University, and eventually found his way to Rome. And during Henry VIII's attempts to secure his annulment of the to secure the annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn, he basically suggested that Reginald Pole, his cousin, they were related, could be a great person whilst he's in Italy to convince the Pope and the sort of the papal legates and everything that it was the way to go and to get the support from the Italian universities. And at the time, Reginald showed every sign that he was willing to do this, and that he sided with the king, and that he would provide him with all of his findings in due course. But actually, Reginald Pole really sort of vacillated and didn't send anything about the king's decision to marry Anne Boleyn until after Anne Boleyn was executed. So after Anne Boleyn was executed, so we're jumping now to 1536, he released a letter to the king, although actually it's called a letter, but it was a small book called De Unitate, and it was a blistering attack on the king. He called him a beast. He likened him to Nero and Caligula, the sort of the ancient Roman dictators, and this understandably caused immediate problems for the Pole family that were back in England. So really, sort of during Anne Boleyn's 3 years on the throne, the Pole family, by and large, kept their heads down, did what they had to do to survive. Their loyalties remained with Catherine in heart, but like a lot of people, they went along with what Henry VIII asked of them and kept their heads. But that would all change, not long after.
No, yeah. I read, where did I read it? I think it's Wolf Hall, because obviously that's a fabulous series and you see a lot more of the Poles.
I
Is
think
it.
season two. Yeah, there's going to be a lot more. Well, I know that Harriet Walter has been cast as Margaret Pole in season two. So, casting a dame in Margaret Pole's role would suggest it's going to be a much bigger role than it was in season one. So, that's exciting.
What do you think was the exact moment that pinpointed her downfall?
There isn't an exact moment per se, it's a series of events that fell into place. And it's a bit like the downfall of Anne Boleyn, I suppose. It was a series of conversations and offhand comments that just eventually led to Margaret's downfall and many other people's downfall as well. It started really in the summer of 1538 and has become known as the Exeter Conspiracy. And at its crux, the conspiracy was said to have been created, and I'm saying said because it is pure conspiracy, but the conspiracy's aim was supposedly the removal of Henry VIII from the throne and then to place Edward Courtenay, the Marquess of Exeter, on the throne in his place. And it's this reason why it's called the Exeter Conspiracy, because the Marquess was the most senior person involved, and it was to him that the throne was supposedly go to. Even though, to my mind, actually, when I looked at the evidence put forward of all of the people that would eventually lose their that would eventually lose their lives, he was one of the least guilty. And there was the least information or evidence against him. And really, it wasn't a conspiracy. And I argue in my book that in actuality, it was just a bit of banter and a bit of whinging, really, that then was twisted into a major court case. However, and this is a crucial thing to always keep in mind, is that some of this banter and some of this whinging did include words which crossed a line into treason, but only under the strict interpretation of treason of the day. And that's based around the updated Treasons Act of 1534. The main issue, ultimately, was Reginald Pole. He was safe in Italy, threatening the king. One of the things that Reginald Pole did, for example, was openly show support for the Pilgrimage of Grace and threatened to to bring together an army from across Europe who would invade England in support of the Pilgrimage of Grace. And it got so bad that Francis Bryan, the one-eyed bad boy, was sent into Europe to assassinate Reginald. And it's actually one of the few things the Tudors gets right. But the fact that Reginald was safely ensconced in Italy, basically chatting shit about the king, it just put such a lens on his family, and it drove Henry mad. It drove Henry VIII mad. Now, there is more to it than that. Geoffrey Pole, who is the youngest of the Pole siblings, is kind of as equally guilty in some respect. Oh, I sounded like Snape then. Guilty. He's equally as guilty as Reginald in the sense that he was, he said certain things that were by and large were considered treasonous, but they were, it was offhand comments and banter, but this was a time when comments could see you killed. I mean, the thing that a lot of people don't necessarily understand about what led Anne Boleyn to the scaffold was that comment about dead men's shoes. Because technically, actually, adultery, even though we all know she was innocent, the crime of adultery wasn't actually treason. It was the fact that she'd supposedly thought about and spoken about the king's death that was the thing that sealed her fate. And it's kind of the same, really, with the Pole family. What was a massive problem for Geoffrey Pole was that he was in debt throughout basically all of his adult life and had complained to his eldest brother, Henry, saying how much he wanted to leave England. And Henry Pole responded that, he understood where Geoffrey was coming from, that they felt that the English court was coming apart. They described that the world was coming to stripes. Now, exactly what Henry Pole meant by the world coming to stripes isn't totally clear, although the link that I did think What I think he was alluding to was a general breakdown of law, because even in the 16th century, so you know how nowadays it's synonymous for stripes to be synonymous with what people wear in prison. It was the same in the 16th century. And so I think what he was sort of talking about there was that under the rule of Henry VIII and the dissolution of the monasteries and everything, that basically criminals had overtaken all sense. And A key piece of the evidence used against the Marquess of Exeter was an exchange that he supposedly had of Henry Pole, in which he claimed that he liked well the proceedings of Reginald Pole, who obviously, as I've discussed, was talking shit about the king. And this really was kind of the sole piece of evidence that they pinned against the Marquess of Exeter, and that he hoped for a fair day upon the knaves that rule about the king, and that he trusts to see a merry world one day. And the inference there was that this merry world would be one in which the king was dead. So these were like, you know, these gossipy comments between friends and relatives ultimately provided the basis for the Exeter conspiracy. And that's basically it. You know, that was what was used as evidence. And the really tragic part is that the evidence came from Geoffrey Pole, who told his captors all of this information. So Geoffrey Pole was the first of the nobility involved in the Exeter conspiracy to be arrested. A servant of his, Hugh Holland, had been arrested first, and then Geoffrey was brought in for questioning and told his inquisitors all about these conversations that he'd had with Henry, with his brother Henry Pole, and with the Marquess of Exeter, and so on. And it is what led to Henry Pole's arrest and later execution, the Marquess of Exeter's execution, Sir Edward Neville's execution, Sir Nicholas Carew's execution, as well as the execution of three common men, so George Crofts, Hugh Holland, and John Collins. And actually, Geoffrey Pole basically went insane in prison, and he attempted suicide twice. And, you know, this is an age when suicide was seen as the gravest of sins, and he attempted suicide. And I think he attempted suicide because he had given so much evidence against his family, which also led to Margaret's eventual arrest for her supposed involvement in the Exeter conspiracy. But it's definitely my belief that she was innocent of any, it's my belief that all of the men ultimately were innocent of actual plotting, but they were just talking like friends do, and moaning about things, moaning about the changes that they'd seen. But that was enough, you know, it, at this period in history, that was enough. But with Margaret, it was really, really difficult. They couldn't find evidence to pin against her. Because as much as Geoffrey Pole had spoken about his brother and, you know, his other kin, he did not talk about Margaret Pole, his mother. But the belief was that if her sons were guilty, Margaret must have been party to it. But they just couldn't find any evidence against her. And therefore, suddenly, a piece of evidence was uncovered. So when Margaret was eventually attainted for treason, she'd been imprisoned at Cowdray House with the Earl of Southampton. He was their sort of jailer, kept her at his home. And there were rounds and rounds and rounds of questioning. They were never able to find anything really to pin against her. And then a search is done of her homes and a tunic is discovered. And this tunic supposedly showed two lines of flowers that eventually joined together. And the flowers were the pansy, which was the Pole family sigil, which was then intertwined with the Tudor rose. And the inference was that this tunic was a sign that the Pole family, Margaret, intended for Lady Mary, the Henry VIII's daughter, to marry Margaret's son, Reginald. And it therefore was also sort of seen as proof that there was this long-harbored plan to displace the throne in favor of Mary with Reginald as her consort. I'm very skeptical of this piece of evidence, though, simply because it's very convenient that it was just suddenly sort of, it was basically very dramatically pulled out during the reading of Margaret's attainder by Thomas Cromwell. And we know from the downfall of Anne Boleyn that Thomas Cromwell was not above creating fake evidence. So either this tunic was a legitimate tunic that just was a lovely piece of art showing the descent of the Poles and the Tudors from the same line, or it was made up by Cromwell, but it was the piece of evidence that convinced the king to move against Margaret Pole and authorize her imprisonment and the attainder, which passed the sentence of death against her.
That's a lot. I was just thinking about the tunic.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, I was like, what did I say? Do you think Thomas Cromwell had an agenda against the Pole family? Do you think he was the instigator against the family to bring them to death? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, the Pole family were religiously conservative by nature, and a family of such prominence and wealth as them, and the Marquess of Exeter, another very, very prominent noble family, held no love for Thomas Cromwell. They held no love for the dissolution of the monasteries. And really, this was a very convenient way of wiping out a group of people who could and would prove very problematic for Cromwell's plans. And so his hand is undoubtedly across the Exeter conspiracy. And you know, we can see that. And, you know, what I've discussed a moment ago is just the tip of the iceberg, really, of what's involved in the Exeter conspiracy. There's a lot more in there that, you know, we would need a podcast that was 4 hours long to explain it all. But, you know, one of the pieces of information that really shows us that Cromwell was pulling the strings is that a servant of his who was from the Midlands crops up out of nowhere at a church that was within Margaret's lands in Hampshire, hours away from where he was from, and starts sort of sifting around, trying to find gossip and information about Margaret and her son's behaviour. And a servant of Cromwell suddenly appears in the vicinity of Margaret Pole's household and starts sending information back to Cromwell. So, yeah, Cromwell's hand is very much across the Exeter conspiracy. And I think that, like the downfall of Anne Boleyn, Cromwell was the architect. However, I must also stress that Reginald Pole is just as culpable in what drove Henry VIII to act the way he did. And I think that I think the one person that could have been spared was Margaret Pole, and she would have been spared had Reginald dialed down on the way he was talking about the king. I think that's a strong possibility that she would have survived. The most shocking part of the story ultimately is that Geoffrey Pole does survive. He's pardoned and released from the Tower, despite the fact that there was so much more evidence to suggest that he had said treasonous things, and there was his elder brother or the Marquess of Exeter or Sir Nicholas Carew. But I think the fact that it's difficult to say exactly how did this man manage to get off, but I think it was because he gave so much evidence against his family and was obviously so badly damaged by what he'd done that in the end it was decided that he could go free, and you know, he was a shadow of his former self. But yeah, in a very long-winded answer, yes, Cromwell is all over this.
No, I just asked that. I asked that because obviously, and I think it's had the way Hilary Mantel portrays Thomas Cromwell, he's got an agenda against them because they look down the nose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have been true. I think that they would have viewed Cromwell as a sort of inferior person. You know, they were members of the old nobility, and the likes of the Duke of Norfolk was very much the same. The Duke of Buckingham, really I think it was, you know, his own arrogance is what eventually led to his execution. So there would have been an issue. There would have been difficulties between the Pole family and Cromwell. But I think it was the fact that it was their, it was what exacerbated all of their problems was the blood that ran in their veins. And I think that can also be really seen in this, in the fact that Margaret Pole is eventually executed, but Gertrude Courtenay, the wife of the Marquess of Exeter, isn't. Even though, again, there is a lot of evidence that that Gertrude Courtenay was acting treasonously, certainly a lot more on paper than Margaret. But Margaret was a Plantagenet, Gertrude married one. And I think that is the big distinction, really. And that's what exacerbated Margaret and her son's problem was the blood that ran in their veins and the fact that there was nothing that they could do about it. And that as Henry VIII's reign went on and Cromwell orchestrated, you know, the huge change in policies, it was only ever going to really end in disaster for the families such as the Poles and the Courtenays, who represented a very different style of rule and were living embodiments of the old dynasty that the Tudors had overthrown.
No, yeah, you're completely right. Was Margaret imprisoned for a long time, you know?
Yeah, she was. Yeah. So, and this is again, it's one of the things that leads me to think that Henry VIII did eventually intend to release her. She was imprisoned for over 2 years, you know, compared to her son. I mean, her son was beheaded, Henry Pole was beheaded within a week of his trial, you know, and that was pretty customary. George Boleyn was beheaded just 2 days after his trial. So the fact that she was imprisoned for such a long time before her eventual death was unusual. And unlike what is shown in the Tudors, you know, this woman in a dank cell trying to get a comb through knotted hair, that wasn't the case at all. She had a suite of rooms at the Tower of London. We don't know exactly where, but she was treated well. And there is also evidence in the records that Catherine Howard sent Margaret a series of furred nightgowns and things to generally aid in her incarceration. And Henry VIII would have had to have signed off on that, and he allowed it, which suggests that, you know, Margaret, yes, a prison is a prison, but she was kept in relative comfort. But then something changed, and you know, after sort of a 2 year imprisonment, Henry VIII travelled north with Catherine Howard on Progress, and after leaving London, it was announced that they were to just clear the tower out, basically, of remaining prisoners, and that is what led to Margaret's eventual execution on the 27th of May, 1541.
Gosh, it's so tragic, isn't it? When you put a life like that, you know, she difficult start because of her dad and her brother, sadly, was executed, and her husband sadly died, and it's just sad. It's
Oh,
just so sad.
yeah, it's crazy. I mean, her father was executed, her brother was executed, her eldest son was executed, her father-in-law was executed. You know, this was a woman surrounded by tragedy in many respects, but also had years of incredible luxury and you know, the very best of things. It was a very, very volatile life. It was one of intense highs and staggering lows, really. And Margaret's execution is also another, it's quite a famous, it's an infamous execution, I suppose we should say, for the supposedly bungled and dramatic nature of it. Although I'm pleased to report that some of the theories put forward about Margaret's execution are spurious or largely made up. It's difficult to say exactly what happened on the morning of her execution. We do know that she was awoken at 7 a.m. and told that you're about to die. And she was shocked and said, but, you know, because the thing is, in the era of the Tudors, there was, you know, something known as a mors improviso, which was basically a sudden death. And in an age when religion and religious belief was so intense, people dreaded a sudden death. They dreaded Moore's improviser. And so Margaret being told very quickly, you're about to be killed, was not only a massive shock, but it robbed her of the chance to spend a lot of time putting her, I suppose for want of a better word, spiritual affairs in order. You know, this was a woman who's very religious, and she's basically woken up and told, yep, today's the day, kind of thing. And it was such a rushed job that there wasn't even a scaffold. And that is immediately one of the things that goes against the famous account of Margaret's execution is that she, you know, was this tough old bird who basically refused to put her head down on the block and jumped up, ran around a scaffold being hacked apart. And it's a good story. Well, it's not a good story. It's a dramatic story, but it's also made up, I'm pleased to report. What it is sad to report is that the execution was nonetheless very badly botched. There wasn't a scaffold, and the block was also very low to the ground, to such a degree that she basically had to lie down. She wasn't even able to kneel. She had to lie on the ground with her head over a low wooden block. The regular Tower executioner had gone north with the king, and essentially an axe was put into the hands of, well, Chapuis described him as a wretched, blundering youth who hacked her apart, basically. It took many blows of the axe to kill her. The story about her running around a scaffold, and based on the accounts of those that saw it, it was an undeniably very badly botched execution, but not in the way that it's necessarily told. It was quite a quiet execution. There was only about 100, maybe 150 people. And even that night, there was a lot of, you know, it was still being doubted across London as to whether it had actually happened. She eventually died. She was 67 at the time, which is ancient by Tudor standards. She was, I think, very prematurely aged as well. I mean, she looked so elderly that Chapuis, in an account to Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, he wrote to him that she was 90 years old, because that's how she looked. She wasn't. She was 67. Rex. She was 67, but she looked much older than her years, and even then, you know, 67 was still old for the time. She was then buried in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, which is where she remains to this day. And during the reign of Queen Victoria, her remains were uncovered at the same time that the remains of Anne Boleyn were uncovered. And we can't say for definite that it was her, but the remains discovered were in the spot where she was said to be buried, and they belonged to a tall woman of advanced years, and the only woman of advanced years who was executed at the time was Margaret Pole, which leads many, myself included, to conclude that the bones that were uncovered in 1880 something were indeed her remains.
She's just a fascinating woman, absolutely, to the end. And I've been St. Peter ad Vincula many years ago, but you definitely have a presence when you're standing in front of two queens, well, three queens, sorry, Lady Jane Grey and Lady Margaret Pole. Is Jane Rochford buried under the altar as well?
Yes, she is. She's next door to Margaret Pole.
Next door. Final question about Margaret Pole before I ask you non-studious Tudor questions, as I call them. What do you think Margaret Pole's legacy was?
Well, she was beatified as a martyr to the Catholic faith many, many years later. I think her legacy really was the fact that this was a woman who lived, I think really her legacy was that she was a living, I describe her in the book as a bit of a living dinosaur for Henry VIII's court, because she was older than most people at the time and had seen so much, and it made her not unique, but certainly one of the few people who could very well remember the reign of Edward IV and had lived through all of the trauma of Henry VII. And I think that actually, one thing that's quite nice about Margaret's descendants is that actually, as much as she and her family really disliked Anne Boleyn, actually, one of Margaret's granddaughters would go on to serve Elizabeth I and was very, very, and the two were very, very close. Dorothy Stafford, who was the daughter of Ursula Pole, was very high in Elizabeth I's favour and was not high in Mary I's favour, which is ironic considering how much Margaret was, you know, loved Mary. But because Dorothy had been raised Protestant, when Mary came to the throne, she and her husband fled England and only returned when Elizabeth came to the throne. So in this sort of shift of the irony is that Margaret's descendants really shifted away from Margaret's beliefs and sort of went over to the other side and to sort of Elizabeth's side. And actually it was in Dorothy Stafford that in the end, her son was able, when she died at the age of about 80, and her son was able to erect this memorial for her in Westminster Abbey that really commends the lineage that she was born from and the lineage of Margaret Pole. And I think that's quite fitting, really, that actually Margaret's granddaughter, the daughter of her, of Margaret's only daughter, who was the least consequential of her five children, it was in that line that emerged the individual who had the scope to honour Margaret Pole in Westminster Abbey, the most famous and important church in the UK today. And I think that really, I think, is a lovely legacy. And just, as I said, the fact that she saw it all, you know, this was an extraordinary life that ended in complete tragedy, but was nonetheless a full and fascinating one.
No, I completely agree, and I've really enjoyed listening, learning, and talking about Margaret Pole with you. And if no one purchases the book in July, once listening to this podcast, I will all come for you. Buy his book. But as before I let you go, because I've took so much of your time, I'll be still definite on what your Tudor pet peeve is.
Well, I have two, if that's okay. And they're kind of related. And I've kind of already covered it. But basically, it's definitely people quoting the work of Philippa Gregory or shows like The Tudors or don't even get me I can barely say the word rain without wanting to come out in hives. But people quoting that as fact, it drives me nuts because it's just, yeah, so inaccurate. And yes, shows like The Tudors, as I discussed earlier, they brought audiences to the Tudors as a period of history, which is great. But by and large, I just thought the show was silly and fluffy. It was history dumbed down. And the second, and it's sort of the extension of that, and you see it most, I see it most in those two shows, The Tudors and Rain, is really poor costuming in Tudor dramas. It's, for me, just really lazy. I don't understand why the costume designers on shows like The Tudors can't get it right when we've got so many portraits and records of what the Tudors wore that I don't understand why they can't just follow that. And it's one of the reasons why I actually loved Becoming Elizabeth, the earlier 1970s series like Elizabeth R or The Six Wives of Henry VIII. They paid really close attention to the costumes, and for me it makes the series feel more believable because I'm watching it and going, that's a French hood, that's what a French hood should look like, you know, and rather than that ridiculous things that they put Natalie Dormer in. I mean, over the whole two seasons she was Anne Boleyn, I didn't see a single French hood that's so synonymous with Anne Boleyn, and I know I'm sounding very over the top about it, but I just don't get it. Like, for me, costumes is the easiest thing to get right. So I get very frustrated when they get it very, very wrong.
No, I agree, because I think it was just talking to my mum about it, bless her. I feel like we've gone backwards. You know, the 70s, the costumes were so amazing.
Yeah, they were.
And then we go backwards.
Yeah.
And I can't talk about Claire Foy's French hoods. I can't do it.
Oh, what was that? It was like, and I actually loved Claire Foy, and I thought she was an incredible Anne Boleyn. A lot of people hated her as Anne Boleyn. I loved her as Anne Boleyn. She's my second favourite after Geneviève Bujold. But those French hoods needed to be burned because they were, I mean, it was like a strip of plastic with a sheer veil attached to it. And it baffled me because by and large, they actually played quite close attention to the rest of the costumes. Like the way they were pinned in the arm and things like that were all quite accurate. But then the French hoods were just dog shit. I just didn't get it. But from the set photos from season two, they've improved on the French hoods, I'm pleased to say.
Yeah, I think it was you that posted it, and I went, thank God they actually look accurate.
Yeah, totally.
Because it is a bugbear. Yeah. It's my pet peeve. Well, I've got too many Tudor pet peeves, but have you got a favourite Tudor book, fiction or non-fiction?
I do, yes. It's one, I think it's one of the best books I've ever read. It's The Private Lives of the Tudors by Tracy Borman. It's an incredible book, and I actually listened to it on Audible because I find audiobooks the easiest way of, you know, as a historian, it's difficult for me to find the time to read, so audiobooks just provide that amazing way of absorbing lots of information. The Private Lives of the Tudors is phenomenal. It's a masterpiece of a book, and for anyone who hasn't read it, it basically tells the story of the Tudor era, the Tudor dynasty, and it, you know, from Henry VII through to the death of Elizabeth I. And it's just packed full of amazing anecdotes and stories. It's really rich in detail. Very, very easy to, I mean, it's Tracy Borman, you know, top of her field. So, you know, it's just a brilliant book. It's so informative. I learned so much from it that was complete news to me. And as I said, it's full of amazing bits of trivia and stuff like that. And I love a bit of trivia. You know, it's one of the things that Tracy Borman mentions is the fact that Tudor beds had pulleys on them that would draw curtains in. And that's the origin of the saying sleep tight, for example. So stuff like that, I loved. And that book is full of stuff like that.
No, it is one of my favourites. I think it was that book and Alison Weir's Six Wives of Henry VIII were the first two books I read that got me into the Tudor period properly, because once I ditched the Tudors, I started reading Tudor books.
Yeah, the Alison Weir one, I think it's about over 20 years old now, isn't it? Yeah. There's a lot. I was chatting to someone the other day and they said it needs a rerun because it's now a bit dated in some respects. But it's a good book, and I've read her book on Henry VIII as well. I just love Tracy Borman's books.
Yeah.
And she's such an amazing, she's a lovely, I've had the pleasure to meet Tracy a few times, and she's a dream. She's a lovely, lovely lady.
No, I love Tracy. All the documentaries she's on, I'm there.
Yeah.
Final question is, have you got a favourite Tudor fact?
A favourite Tudor fact? Yes, I think that my favourite Tudor fact is that Elizabeth I had a spy master. He was called Dr. John Dee. Well, he was called Dr. John Dee, and he was her doctor, as the title would suggest, but he was also a part-time spy for her. And he was a bit of an astrologer. He was a bit of a jack of all trades, really. And he would send coded letters to her. And his code name was 007. And I just think that's brilliant. And must surely, it's too much of a coincidence. So I'm convinced that Ian Fleming, when he was creating James Bond, discovered that and used it. Because it's just too much of a coincidence. But I would say that's my favourite Tudor fact.
That's a really good one. I love learning who I've had on, what their favourite Tudor facts are. But thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And I heartily recommend listeners to also give your podcast a listen as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. Yeah, it's a lot of work, isn't it, a podcast?
But
I do two episodes a week because I have my main episodes, and then I have a subscriber episode as well. So I'm doing two a week, which is it's quite a lot to get out, but it's great and I'm loving it. And actually, the episode I've got coming this Thursday, I'm really excited about because it's very unusual. It's about the fact that there was a Japanese guy at the court of Elizabeth I, and I'm discussing his story with a guy called Thomas Lockley, who's written a book about him. And it's, you know, complete news to me, and I'm sure it'll be news to a lot of people about this Japanese man's time at the court of Elizabeth I. But yeah, it's going well so far. So thank you so much for inviting me.
No, thank you so much for having. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're very welcome.